Lydia, I want to turn to you now as someone who works with advising companies on a daily basis on how to comply with this. So, you know, on top of the Privacy Shield commitments that Jim talked about, on its face, GDPR has a pretty large extraterritorial reach under Article 3 in establishment or targeting. So what I'm wondering is, when you talk to clients or when you feel questions from clients, you know, how do you advise them as far as how, you know, how are you seeing them deal with GDPR and how, you know, are they taking steps to comply with GDPR for fear of the extraterritorial reach or just maybe out of economic concerns that, well, maybe there's not legal compulsion for me to do this, but, you know, hey, complying with a U.S. regime and an EU regime just doesn't make sense. I'll just go ahead and comply with the EU regime.
Great. Thank you, James. Thank you so much for the invitation to participate in this panel. It really is, I'm sure that you've all found the everybody's remarks and the presentation to be incredibly informative and, frankly, as I think somebody has already said, pretty depressing. It's although maybe a little bit of hope with Privacy Shield. Let me kind of start with a little bit of background as well, and I will do this pretty quickly. So I was in Brussels last month and meeting with folks there, both government officials and people in NGOs and, you know, and companies. And one thing that is so striking to me is that across the board, everybody feels as if there is absolutely no data protection in the United States. You know, it's out there. There's nobody doing anything to protect the rights of data subjects. This is such a serious misconception of U.S. Data privacy law. As James indicated in his opening remarks and Commissioner Phillips reiterated, you know, the U.S. has very strong privacy laws. They're just different. We have a risk-based approach, but we have actually a lot of federal laws that implement this risk-based approach. There's, you know, I think we mentioned there are laws in the health sector, in the financial sector, you know, HIPAA, GLBA. There are laws that deal with marketing, the telemarketing sales rule, the CAN-SPAM Act, COPPA, that deals with children's privacy, the FCRA, which is old and I think, you know, kind of like the oldest privacy law in the United States. We have self-regulatory programs that industry has adopted and that are also risk-based and that are, when companies make a commitment that they will comply with those self-regulatory programs, those commitments are enforced by the FTC, and there are plenty of significant commission cases that challenge self-regulatory commitments as allegedly deceptive. There are, you know, 50-plus data breach notification laws on the state level. And then, you know, kind of on top of all of this, there is very aggressive enforcement by the FTC. The FTC has relied on Section 5 that prohibits, you know, unfair and deceptive acts or practices to essentially develop over a 20-year period a very strong laws governing data privacy in the U.S. You know, companies take compliance with U.S. privacy laws very seriously. But for the most part, what they've got are general rules and the ability to take those general rules and implement them within their organizations in ways that work best. So that is far from the case when we're talking about the GDPR. It is an incredibly specific prescriptive law. And so I just want to kind of give a couple of examples. I think, you know, Liad was talking about the legitimate interests. So for an entity to be in compliance with the GDPR, for an organization, a company to be in compliance with the GDPR, it can only process the personal information of EU data subjects if it has a legitimate basis for doing so. Okay, that seems pretty general and workable, but the law specifies 7 specific legitimate interests. Consent, as was mentioned, but then it can be, if you don't use consent, and actually we don't always advise companies that are working on compliance to rely on consent. We think that that is probably kind of the least effective and least favored legitimate interest in the EU, because if you rely on consent, consent has to be freely given but also freely withdrawn. So you have to give a data subject the ability to withdraw that consent, and then you may have their data and it may be intertwined with other data that you're using, and it just becomes, you know, pretty much of a mess. So we use consent or recommend that clients use consent when they can't find any other basis. The other bases: a compliance necessary to perform a contract. Somebody wants to buy something from you, you know, they have to give you a credit card and their address so that you can ship them the product. Necessary to comply with a legal obligation to protect the vital interests of a data subject or another natural person, perform a task that's carried out in the public interest. And all of these interests can be overridden by the fundamental rights of the data subject or some other natural person. I have to say this has been in effect now for, 18 months, and it's been kicking around for 18 months at least before that, and I think it is incredibly difficult to work with companies and help them comply with this one aspect of the GDPR. Basically, what it means, any organization that employs more than, I think it's 250 employees or is engaged in a high-risk data processing activity, which, you know, is almost any data processing activity, has to maintain a detailed list of all of its data processing activities. And this is what, you know, we commonly refer to as creating a data map. And so it's a list of each piece of data and that the company collects, the legitimate basis for collecting that piece of data. And then, you know, there are many fields in a comprehensive data map, including, the data retention for that specific piece of data. You know, as you can see, this is just this alone. I mean, Jim mentioned the cost of complying with the GDPR. Developing an accurate data map is a surprisingly complex, resource-intensive, and just very expensive process for companies. And it is particularly challenging for small and mid-sized companies. If you're a large multinational company, you are very likely to have a pretty sophisticated internal privacy team and to, you know, kind of understand what data you're collecting and how it's flowing. Oh, I should note, you know, the data map, not only kind of like the piece of data that you've collected and your basis for collecting it, but all of the different ways that it flows, who you're sharing it with, you know, how it's working, this individual category of data, how it works its way through your system and how it's being shared with third parties and service providers and other business partners. That alone is a daunting process. I'm going to kind of jump to one of the other GDPR requirements. And so if you are attempting to comply with the GDPR, you also have to have a written data processing agreement in place with all of your data processors, any vendor, partner, other third party that you deal with, who you share information with, you have to have a data processing agreement. Well, again, not such a big deal, really, because if you are engaged with another company, if you're a U.S. company and you hire a service provider, you have a contract in place, of course, and you know you negotiate it. But again, the GDPR this time has 8 topics that have to be addressed in this contract. There are actually templates that have been approved for use. But essentially what we're talking about here is also companies attempting to comply with the GDPR need to do a comprehensive review of all of the contracts they have with third parties and essentially renegotiate those contracts. Again, an incredibly daunting process for companies. Let me touch on I'm not going to go through all of the topics that you need to address in these contracts, but take it from me, it is incredibly detailed. And what companies, what controllers are essentially doing is imposing a set of very serious compliance obligations on their vendors. The third area that I wanted to touch on, it's more familiar to us. The GDPR imposes data security and data breach notification requirements when companies experience various incidents. But again, the GDPR implementation of this is quite different than how we deal with data breach notification in the U.S. If personal data held by an organization is exposed, the organization is required to notify its supervisory authority within 72 hours. Very, very short period of time. I will tell you, many companies in the U.S., their supervisory authority is the Irish DPA. I will tell you the Irish DPA takes a very strict reading of this, you know, kind of 72 hours from the time, you know, from the first time you know about this. And I can tell you we work with many companies that experience these kind of incidents, and it is difficult in 72 hours to even wrap your arms around what's gone on. It can take, you know, weeks to really understand what the intrusion is, whether there actually is any risk of harm. And then, you know, kind of finally, companies that are trying to comply with the GDPR have to honor a very long list of privacy rights that data subjects can exercise. And again, I'm sure you're very familiar with that. We're seeing much of that in the CCPA also. Some of these rights are similar to what to rights that are outlined in the FCRA, but again, much broader. It applies to kind of all entities, not only entities that are considered to be consumer reporting agencies. So, you know, essentially access, the right to correct, the right to delete, the right to be forgotten. Okay, so I know we're hitting up against the hour, and James, your question is, you know, what do we tell companies to do in the face of all of this? I can assure you that there are very few small to medium-sized companies in the United States that can spend anywhere near $1 million to comply with a law like this. And yet, it's important, and I think, James, you really hit on this. It's not just a matter of of legal compliance, and the GDPR does have extraterritorial effect, so legal compliance is significant, but it's also a matter of kind of staying in business. If you're a service provider and you're trying to offer your services to companies that operate in the EU, their contracts, U.S. companies that are bringing data over from the EU, they will require that you sign contracts that make commitments about your compliance with EU privacy laws. So this really kind of hits small and medium-sized companies in a whole variety of ways. I will say, kind of what are they doing? So I think most companies are doing at least a light touch. They are revising their privacy policies to reflect GDPR requirements, and they may be revising their terms of use also. We certainly advise companies to go first to Privacy Shield. It is, as I hope you are all hearing, detailed compliance with the GDPR can be overwhelming and, almost, I would say almost impossible for a small or medium-sized company to comply with. We've heard, I think Jim mentioned that, a lot of U.S. companies are opting out of the EU market. I mean, that's certainly not something that we advise our clients to do. It's an important market. And so we do, we really are, we are actively marketing Privacy Shield as a solution for smaller companies, but we do see a real risk there because there's some question as to whether it will survive. So I guess I've added, kind of another kind of layer of how depressing this all is. The one positive I will say that we've seen is that companies that may not have paid a lot of attention to data privacy kind of before the GDPR and Privacy Shield and before this was all, kind of top of mind for companies, they are doing so. And I think that is a good thing for companies to become more aware of the importance of understanding their privacy practices. I certainly hope Privacy Shield survives. And I guess, my kind of last note on this is, although I have been an incredible pessimist about comprehensive federal privacy legislation ever passing in the U.S., I'm going to try my best to be an optimist and hope that something positive happens on that score. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Lydia. We are kind of right up against time, but Noah, I know you've kind of sat here from your remarks. I don't know if you had any reactions or anything you want to have, and I have a couple questions from the audience, but I thought I'd give you a chance. Since you kicked things off, if you want to have the last word.
Sure. I think I want to leave more time for the audience to ask questions. I think that's probably the most important.
Okay. Well, then what about this? Here's one that's actually directed to Liad, but if what would you think would happen to your results if the U.S. and other jurisdictions pass GDPR-like legislation? Would you expect then investment would return to Europe, everything would be good?
I'm going to concur with Lydia on this, if we take CCPA as an example, while it has bite in certain areas, it's considerably watered down compared to GDPR. I just don't think it's likely for a GDPR-like law to take place in the U.S.
Okay. Do you think it would have any impact? I mean, if let's say that there are a couple bills kicking around here on Capitol Hill, if they were to pass and have GDPR-like, would
Would there be an impact? Yes.
Yes. we'll, I guess another question. Oh, I'm sorry, Lydia, did you have?
No.
Okay.
Can I actually
Can
I ask a follow-up question? Just briefly, this is the one thing I had sort of flagged as a question for you. In one of the charts, Liad, that you presented, foreign investment in the EU was going down. But I noticed, or I thought I saw, that the foreign investment line for the U.S. was going up. Do you think that there's a causal relationship between those two, meaning that some of the money that would otherwise be invested in the EU is coming to us?
Yeah, so I think that venture investment broadly has gone up, but the EU did not benefit from that rise.
Okay. They're just not part of the secular trend.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
So I think this would probably be more directed to you, Jim, but I imagine anyone can jump in. With most technology platforms targeting audiences without regard to borders, do you see any role for international organizations playing? What is the role for international organizations here as opposed to, say, bilateral agreements like Privacy Shield or APEC?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a role. I know the OECD privacy guidelines are up for review. I think I can't remember if it's every 5 years or every 6 years, but it's going on now. I think there's a lot of interest, a lot of it promulgated by GDPR's implementation in May of 18, but a lot of other countries looking at these issues, and of course, what seems like every other month another scandal with a breach or a disclosure by a big company. So it's driving a lot of global interest in this. But the OECD has been, as I noted earlier, and as I'm sure everyone in this room knows, it's been the basis for so many different privacy laws. So I think there's a lot of interest there. I know Japan and Prime Minister Abe, Japan has the G20 presidency this year. Prime Minister Abe has made data governance one of the key pillars of what he'd like to focus on. I think, quite frankly, I think he's tired of watching the U.S. and the EU squabble over their differences about how to deal with these issues, and he'd like to bring everyone together. It's not as easy as it sounds. I think there is some cause for optimism there. I think Japan is an honest broker. They, have been a phenomenal partner on the APEC CBPR system and helping to grow that. We've now doubled that in size in the last 2 years. On the other hand, they're also, I think, the first to have this mutual adequacy approach with the EU. So they're sort of very well positioned, again, as sort of an honest broker to bring the two sides together to the extent that they can. As I alluded to, the APEC cross-border privacy rule system, we have put a lot of energy into growing it. I think there was a bit of a chicken and egg dynamic there. Companies were waiting for more buy-in from APEC economies, the economies were looking for more buy-in from companies. What strikes me in my travels, and I don't know, Noah, if you have a different take on this, I don't know how you cut the baby, but you go to Europe and the conversation is invariably 80% focused on privacy and 20% concern about innovation. You go to the Asia Pacific, it's the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. They are all very eager to capitalize on and leverage the digital economy. But that having been said, with APEC's growth, the APEC CBPR system, we have been getting, particularly now that we have real data coming out on GDPR, some concern because a lot of these countries, again, want to capitalize on the digital economy. Japan itself is extremely concerned over its shrinking population and how do we get more productivity and how do we deal with China. There's a lot of folks very interested in these bridging mechanisms, and we've heard expressions of interest from India, which is not an APEC. We've heard that ASEAN is working on a similar system, the cross-border privacy rules system. So that would be interoperable. And if we could create these linkages, that would be great. So I think to answer your question more directly, there is definitely a role for a multilateral approach here. I think there has to be. I think APEC, I was confused, it's 21 or 28 member economies. We're up to 9 now. But Brazil has expressed interest in CBPR. They're not an APEC member. There's talk about potentially globalizing the CBPR system. Yeah. So, again, I think there is an appetite there now, particularly when you're starting to see real data around some of the unintended consequences around GDPR.
No, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just want to add something to this. So one other thing, I agree with everything that Jim said. One other thing you hear when you go internationally, in particular to the countries that are not in the U.S. and Europe, is a little bit of a frustration at being told how to manage their affairs. This is not the first time that has happened. I talked earlier about the export in political ideas and religious ideas, and this stuff has a very long and sometimes quite sordid history. One of the things I worry about is that, as Lydia noted earlier, it isn't that the U.S. doesn't have privacy law. We don't have one comprehensive statute. We have a series of risk-based laws, not to mention state laws. But we absolutely have a regime that deals with privacy. We have the strongest regime, as I said before, dealing with privacy vis-a-vis the state, which traditionally is the biggest privacy concern. As we think about a world where it is a jump ball or nations are still deciding how to proceed, I do not think it is in the national interest or in the international interest for the U.S. or people in the U.S., and I'm not saying this is the administration, it's not the administration at all, to walk around as if we ought to be in a position of self-flagellation. Our history is one both of protecting privacy and fostering terrific amounts of economic growth. And to the extent Liad's research is correct, and the other road is not so positive, it's not just we who ought to learn that lesson. We ought to be pretty confident in bringing that lesson to others in the world. This is not such a bad place to live. And one of the really interesting things to me, if you think about the jurisdiction that the FTC has, right? So the core of our consumer protection authority is deception, right? Making sure people have the right information on which to make decisions, and unfairness, which at the end of the day is about harm. There is a lot of loose talk about all of the harms that come from data sharing. I mean, Shoshana Zuboff's book, Surveillance Capitalism, that phrase gets used constantly, as if the Stasi is around the corner every time I use an iPhone. And that's just not the reality in which we live. It just isn't. And I think we ought to recognize the fact that, like, there are a lot of goods, too. And those are really important trade-offs. And when other countries are sitting around thinking, what do they really care about? It's not that they're always going to get to where we are. But that when they look at the two sides of the ledger, they ought to see both. And I just think that's really important.
Yeah. Well, I think that's Jim, just was going to say it's a great place to end
like
it. But
mutual admiration society here. I will echo what Noah said. You know, go to a place like India, and you do hear the phrase neocolonialism when they talk about GDPR. Or other countries in Africa that talk about how ridiculous it would be to implement something like GDPR in a place like Kenya. I think, you know, we are, I am a great proponent of, states passing laws that they think work for them. I do think, and I'll just put it in the framework and the lens of how we operate internationally, we are at a disadvantage in not having one law. And that's, I'm not advocating for one law, but I will tell you it is much easier for a country to sit down and say, okay, we need a data privacy law, for them to take GDPR off the shelf, cut out EU and insert their national, you know, their country's name. And when you sit down with them and they say, well, what's the US approach? And you say, well, let's take 3 hours and we'll walk you through our sectoral approach and then I'll walk you through the state laws. And it's not an easy export for us to make. I do think in many ways, and others have said this, this is no great insight on my part, a lot of these issues are technologically generated problems and they're going to have technological solves. I know one of our sister bureaus of commerce, NIST, many of you are probably familiar with the cybersecurity framework that they developed. They are now working, and it's apples to oranges, but on a privacy framework where you can actually build privacy into systems. And, you know, you can generate the settings for where the data will go and what's not to be shared, et cetera. And I think that holds a lot of promise. It's probably a few years out, but I think that's a potential bright spot in the relatively near future.
All right. Well, that's a good way to end it on a positive note. So join me in thanking our panelists for a fantastic discussion.